You have a Bible, please. Would you open it to the 5th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew? As we look at the subject of adultery. As I approach this subject today, I find great pleasure in the fact that we preach expositorially. And we take topics as they come in the text. I say that because I want you to know that I have no one in mind as I preach today except myself. God may have you in mind, but you are not the focus of my sermon this morning individually. I know a lot of details of things, lives in this church, but I really want you to know you are not the reason I wrote this text. When we talk about sex, we know that sex is a great mystery. Sex is, there are two great mysteries in the Scriptures. One is our sexuality, the other is our spirituality. And neither can be discovered by the scientific method, by unaided reason. They must be revealed to us. They must be explained to us. And what the Bible tells us very clearly is that sex is very, very good. Hugh Hefner in Playboy magazine did not invent sex. God did. The book of Genesis is very clear about that matter. Genesis 2 tells us that God created a garden in which He placed a man and a woman, and He gave them the privilege of uninhibited sexual freedom. The two statements that He made there are very striking in Genesis. One is that the two shall become one flesh. And Paul makes it very clear in 1 Corinthians 6 that that expression, becoming one flesh, is an idiom for sexual intercourse. And so it was a gift of God. And secondly, they're told that they were naked and not ashamed. That is, they were unabashedly unashamed in their nakedness. The Bible makes a good case for fig leaves outside of marriage. But within marriage, what God expects is uninhibited freedom in the area of our sexual relationship. Lovemaking is something that God invented. And it's very good. And there is nothing dirty about it. But there is something very wrong with the state of sex today. We speak of sex as something beautiful because we know it should be that way. But the fact is that it's become, in our society, ugly and dull. The relentless pursuits of one-night stands is a very good index of our frustration. A disclosure of our inability to achieve loving, lasting relationships. Rock groups and television shows and movies and the media in general encourage us into all kinds of activities that offer no satisfaction. And Tina Turner wiggles up to the microphone and belts out, "What has love got to do with it?" And totally disconnects sex from relationships and love. Someone has pointed out to me some time ago that less than 6% of the sexual acts in the media take place between husband and wife. In the world of economics, there's a law called Gresham's Law, which basically says that bad money will push out good money. And in many ways, that has been true in the area of sex. 94% of all sex in the media today takes place outside of marriage, which is the context which God has planned for the beautiful act of lovemaking. And so we come to Matthew 5:27. As we continue our series in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus turns from the sixth commandment to the seventh. From the prohibition against murder to the prohibition against adultery. And as we saw last week, Jesus is now going to unfold for us true righteousness. He's going to reveal to us the intent of the Old Testament law. And once again, the rabbis, the Pharisees, were attempting to limit the scope of the commandment, that seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. And although the sin of desiring another man's wife is included in the ninth commandment against covetousness, they evidently found it more comfortable to ignore this. In their view, they and their pupils kept the seventh commandment, provided they avoided the act of adultery itself. They thus gave a very conveniently narrow definition of sexual sin and a conveniently broad definition of sexual purity. But Jesus taught differently. He extended the implications of that commandment. He revealed that the true meaning of God's commandment was much wider than a mere prohibition from the acts of sexual immorality. Just as the prohibition of murder included our angry thoughts and insulting words, so the prohibition of adultery includes the lustful look and our imaginations as well. We can commit murder with our words. We can commit adultery in our hearts and minds. As the sixth commandment is to protect my brother from my hostility, so the seventh commandment is to protect the love in my marriage. Let's look at Jesus' words, beginning at Matthew 5, verse 27. Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of your parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go to hell." Jesus quotes Exodus 20:14, the seventh commandment. The issue is adultery, which is a violation of love, a love for your wife. And Jesus reinterprets this by telling us that the intent of that law needs to be fulfilled in the heart. Because a man can be outwardly faithful, never having committed the act of adultery, and yet inwardly, he's unfaithful. And the result of that inward unfaithfulness is that it erodes away the love that he has for his wife. See, that's Jesus' point. God wants us to love our wives and our husbands with all of our hearts. And he's trying to spare us from those attitudes that affect the love that we have for our wives. And if we permit sexual fantasies to persist in our mind, we can't help the attacks. But if we allow them to persist, they will eventually erode the love that we have for our mates. See, I've always interpreted these verses as if Jesus was merely saying that if we stop the thoughts, then we won't commit the act. And although that's true, I think the point Jesus is making here is that the intent of the law is to teach us how to love. And that the serious thing about sexual fantasies and lust is that it does something for our love for our mates. It just cannot help but prevent a full expression of our love to them. And so it's not a small thing. It's a very serious thing. Sexual fantasies turn active men into passive men at home. Into men who have no emotional ability to connect with their wives. Or desire. And we can justify in our minds thinking that we're not being unfaithful, but Jesus says it really affects our marriage. And Jesus tells us that it's such a serious thing that it requires stern measures. We must discipline ourselves severely. And what is important to grasp is the equation of looking lustfully at a woman and committing adultery with her in our heart. It's the relation between the eyes of the heart and that leads Jesus in the next two verses to give some very practical applications about how to maintain sexual purity. The argument is this: if to look lustfully is to commit adultery in our heart, in other words, if heart adultery is the result of eye adultery, the eyes of our heart being stimulated by the eyes of the flesh, then the only way to deal with the problem is at the beginning, which is our eyes. We chasten those members that evoke the fantasy. And that's what Jesus means when he says, if your right eye makes you stumble, cut it out. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off. Deal with those members that evoke the thoughts that lead to the lessening of your love for your wife or your husband. As the case may be. What is it that provokes sexual fantasy? Well, it's what you see. It's what you touch. Now, he's not speaking literally here. You don't need to chop off your hand or pluck out your eye. He's speaking metaphorically. What he's advocating is not a literal physical self-maiming, but a ruthless moral denial. Not mutilation, mortification is the path to holiness. We need to guard what comes in through the eye gate, what you look at, what you read, what you watch on television, what sort of movies you go to. Don't do those things that make it easy for the flesh to fail. The Lord wants a wholehearted love for our wives. Jesus was quite clear about it. He says it's better to lose one member and enter life maimed than to retain your whole body and go to hell. That is to say, it's better to forego some experiences this life has to offer in order to get life indeed. It's better to be culturally maimed and not be cool and in and find real life. That's his point. And it's based on the principle that eternity is more important than time, and purity is more important than culture. And we have to decide quite simply which life we're living for. To get all the gusto we can out of this one, or whether we're living for another world. And I need at this point to say a word about pornography. And I know I'm speaking at this point to us men more than I am to women. Perhaps you don't think you know anyone who uses pornography. But I can say with a very fair degree of certainty that you do. If not yourself, then certainly somebody in the row you're sitting in. And I can say with a very fair degree of certainty that there are many, many men in this auditorium whose use of it borders on addiction. I know that because pornography is a $12 to $13 billion industry. That's more money, more revenue than Coca-Cola and McDonnell Douglas take in. You no longer have to go to a back alley to get a magazine or a video. It is there in seconds on your computer. And I know that pornography has and is destroying many homes in our body. It can't but help as it slowly erodes the love we have for our wives. I just finished a book which I got the title of my message from, entitled An Affair of the Mind by Lori Hall. And in that book, it's basically her tale, her battle of how she fought to save her family from the abuse of pornography and where it led her husband. And I think sometimes we think of pornography as a victimless crime. However, the victims are our family. And in a period when they were separated, she wrote a number of letters to her husband. She never mailed them to him, but she just did it for her own healing. And in the book, she shares some of those letters that she wrote to him during that time. And I want to read one of them to you. Let me get my glasses. I'm getting old. Dear Jack, we've been separated for 2 whole days now. Funny, I've been counting the hours, just like we did when we first got married. Wow, we've been married 10 whole hours, I'd say. Can you believe it? We've been married 24 whole hours, you'd say. We've been separated 3 whole hours as the countdown started. Right after I hung up, I bundled the kids into the car and headed for Aunt Mary and Uncle George's place. I didn't want to be there when you got home. I couldn't stand to watch you clean out your closet. And I knew I couldn't go through another tearful round of "I'm going to get it together. I really am. Trust me on this." As we're driving down to Massachusetts, I said to the kids, I asked Dad for a separation. It just came out of my mouth the way I'll take a large decaf and one of those cranberry muffins would. I couldn't believe it. Seems like I asked Dad for a separation ought to have a different feeling in my mouth. The words are from another language, one I never thought I'd speak. It should have been harder to wrap my lips around them. We love you, Mom. They said it right together as they'd rehearsed it. They're good kids. They deserve better than this, I thought. Then, you deserve better, Mom. Deserve? What's to deserve in love? Love is about giving. You're supposed to endure all things, hope all things, but I'm too tired to endure anymore. And my hope ran out when I discovered you lied to me once more. How come you're such a liar? Mom, you did everything you could. Sandy's voice sounded firm, calm. Kids shouldn't have to be a cheering squad for their parents' separation. Parents are supposed to cheer their kids on, together. Are you guys okay with this? I asked them. Yeah, Mom, you should have done it a long time ago, Ian said with resignation. It's the wrong answer. But maybe this is going to be all right, I thought. Maybe they're not going to be trashed like other kids whose parents break up. Oh, God, please, please don't let my babies fall apart. Please keep them safe while their family's falling apart. Later, you called to make sure we got there and you wanted to talk to the kids. Why? You never had time to talk to them before. Sandy collapsed. Talking with you brought all her angers and fears to the forefront. She was crying so hard she couldn't get her breath, and I had to catch her as she fell. Ian spent 3 hours on the phone with Tess. He couldn't tell me how he was feeling, but he choked it out to her. Dear God, it's already started. My babies are dying. And I can't do anything to save them. I don't even have enough strength to save myself. That's letter number one. I share that just so we know that it's not a victimless crime. And also that moral collapse is very rarely a blowout. It's almost always a slow leak. The result of 1,000 small indulgences, the consequences of which are never immediately apparent. Hardly anyone plans an adulterous affair. They transition into it. begins with attraction. It's not so much lust as infatuation that brings us down. We find ourselves drawn to somebody who appears sensitive and understanding, someone who listens well and seems to care. We're seduced by that attraction and led on by subtle degrees. Attraction then becomes fantasy. We imagine ourselves with that person and the feeling is good. Fictionalized affairs always seem right. That's their fundamental deception. And the fantasies soften us and our convictions erode. And we're then in a frame of mind to listen to our longings. And having listened, we have no will to resist. And then there are the meetings, the sharing of inner conflict, marital disappointment, and other deep hurts. And with that sharing, the relationship begins to shift. We become two lonely people in need of one another's love. And then comes the inevitable yielding. And with that yielding, the need to justify the affair. We're fools, my friends, if we think we can't fail. We are all in this room frail and unfinished. No matter how willing the spirit, the flesh will always be weak. We are never safe. We're in danger whether we're young or old, married or single, whether in the dumps this morning or on a roll. We'll never be home free until we get home. And our safety doesn't lie in keeping ourselves safe, but in keeping ourselves in God's hands for safekeeping. So what are we supposed to do? Let me give you some suggestions. First, we need to guard our relationship with God. Proverbs tells us, above all else, guard your heart, for it's the wellspring of life. There is a close relationship between human sexuality and human spirituality. And one man observed, sensuality and sanctity are so closely intertwined that our motives in some cases can hardly be separated until the tares are gathered out by the wheat by heavenly wit. Sexual passion is in some inexplicable way a small representation of a much more profound spiritual passion. Our urge to merge ultimately with God. He alone is the one who can gratify the deepest desires of our heart. And devotion to Christ serves to satisfy those deepest longings. And doesn't eliminate those other desires, but it helps to quell them. And when our love for Christ is on the wane, we get restless. And we yearn for things, something more, and our resolve in other areas begins to weaken. Next, we can guard our minds against romantic and sexual fantasies. Our predominant thoughts determine our inevitable actions. What we think is eventually what we inevitably do. But you ask, how can we stop erotic thoughts? As Martin Luther's mentor Philip Melanchthon lamented, old Adam is much too strong for young Philip. He's right. It's true. Our fantasies are much too strong to subordinate. It's much more helpful to redirect them, displace them. When sexual fantasies intrude into our thoughts, you have two choices. You can reinforce them, at which point they become an obsession, or you can sidetrack them into other means, devotion, meditation, prayer. We can cultivate affection for our spouses, always caring about rekindling the love and passion of our marriage, maintaining its romance. That's mutual protection. We are terribly vulnerable if we neglect our marriage and allow it to grow dull and unfriendly. We can watch for infatuations. Augustine confessed that he could not distinguish between the clear shining of affection and the darkness of lust. He further admitted, "I could not keep myself within the kingdom of light where friendship binds soul to soul, and so I polluted the brook of friendship with the sewage of lust." Are we attracted to other women other than our spouse? Do we look forward to being with them? Do we look for excuses to meet them? Do we dress a certain way when we know we're going to be with that person? Do we find ourselves wanting to reach out and touch them, hug them, express affection to them? Do we imagine a romantic or sexual relationship with them? Are we defensive when our spouse expresses uneasiness about a certain relationship? Those are early warning signs of a friendship turning into infatuation. We can guard against intimacy with anyone other than our mates. The secrets of our hearts and our deepest hurts and longings are reserved for them and them alone. We can be alert during periods of unusual pressure. When we're under stress, we ought to be especially weary during seasons that which we're emotionally and physically depleted. When we're lonely, isolated, longing for attention and affirmation, we can regularly rehearse the consequences of an affair. We ought to. We gain insight through hindsight, as someone has said, but foresight's a lot less costly. The writer to Proverbs warns us, "For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's bitter as gall, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead to the grave." Adultery is suicide, and the victim is our soul. One man wrote, "This is the debt I pay just for this one riotous day, years of regret and grief, sorrow without relief. Slight was the thing I bought, small was the debt I thought. Poor was the loan at best, God but the interest." We can publicize our home life, talk lovingly of our spouses, surround ourselves with mementos and pictures, reminders of our marriage. It's good for us. It's good for other people to see. And we can find a friend on who we can unload our darkest secrets, who will not flinch when they hear the sordid tales of our mind, and who will hold a confidence when we tell them all the ugly things that are inside, and who will also hold us accountable, who will ask us those tough questions, and then, having asked those tough questions, ask if we lied on any of them. That's the kind of friend we need. It's a tough message for us, but one we need to hear. Every one of us can fall at any time. We may say, "There, but for the grace of God go I. Better, but there, but for the grace of God I may yet go." And so we need each other. My good friend Steve DePandre shared a poem at our men's retreat that really hit me very hard as God spoke to me as I heard it. And it relates so well to the subject we're talking about today. I asked Steve if he would come and share that poem with us.
Gary did say at the beginning of his message that he hadn't thought of anybody in particular, but he did ask me some time ago if I would do this. So I have to confess, this is not very thrilling to be the one to come up and share about weakness in this area of life. Not much of an ego boost. In the last service, I got to do this with my kids and my wife in the room, as well as all of you, my brothers and sisters. What I have to share with you is a poem that God gave me as I was reading the book of Genesis and contemplating the life of Lot. And he struck me as being so despicable. As I read Genesis, it's about 13 through 19. And yet it's this area of life that Gary has been teaching us this morning about that has made me realize that the distance between myself and a wretched character like Lot is not as great as I would wish. This poem I've called The Screams of the Men of Sodom. Give us the men who have come into this town. We want to have our way with them. We want them to lie down. We want them for our playthings, to satiate our dreams. They are new and we don't know them. Give them to us. Screams. Screams of the men of Sodom filling up the air, pounding on Lot's door at night, demanding something fair. Screams of the men of Sodom echoing off the ground, demanding bodies where no soul can be found. Or only one so foul that God will rain down destructive fire and turn Sodom back to ashes in a blazing funeral pyre. How could Lot have lived there? How long had he closed his eyes? How could he have offered his daughters to be raped and left to die? The angels had to force him out of this wickedest of places. He could not remove his family from the most grotesque of man's embraces. The angels had to seize and send him on his way, and even so he moaned, mumbling, he couldn't go that way. Oh, no, my lords, he whined, thanks, I'm sure, for saving my poor life. But those hills are too far for me, my children and my wife. Let us escape to little Zoar. It's such a tiny place, and there we'll rest and recover from this embarrassing disgrace. When did Lot first learn that his wife had turned to salt? What exactly does this mean? And why did God find fault? The story does not betray any sign of loss or grief. When Lot's life partner died, did he perhaps feel some relief? Had his wife become a burden to him, a mirror in his face, a physical reminder of a life of ruins which nothing could replace? But was he just so busy fleeing, his eyes focused at his feet, that he didn't learn of her wretched fate till after his retreat? The story does not reveal any sign of anger or rage. When Lot's life partner died, did he quietly turn the page, closing his mind to the unpleasant city now burned to blackened rubble? Did he promise a new beginning, a fresh start, freed from trouble? And then, in a drunken stupor in a cave up in the hills, Lot sloshed his way to bed and slept with his two girls. Oh, yes, they tricked him, made him drink beyond control. But no man is blameless who's touched fire to his soul. And is their trick not justified when fear reduced their sight, to think that they alone were left after their deadly flight? And even more, had they heard their father say with apparent ease, "Take my daughters. Do to them anything you please." Only do not touch these men who have come into this town. Virgin daughters of Lot, was there any love left when you laid your father down? Drunken, stupid, lazy, incestuous Lot, faithful Abram's little nephew, who chose what he should not. Fair countryside in Jordan's plain, well watered, lush and green, but with cities full of wickedness and dangers unforeseen. Or was he tired of Abram's faith, of his uncle wandering with God? Was he enticed by the name of Sodom and the feeling in his blood? Did he quietly long to slip in and join the sensuous dream? Did he think he could control it, partake but not be seen? O Father, am I not like Lot? Deep within my soul, do I not deceive myself and think I can control the evil lusts smoldering in my flesh, the craving to have something less take the place of what is best? And when I look upon a woman with selfish, lustful gaze, am I not like Lot, choosing the best place for his cattle to graze? For in seeking any means but you as a way to reach an end, I repeat his selfish error and knock at Sodom's gate again. I know the evils there, a warning deep within my soul, but I have made a game of sin, and now I play a role. I act as if I won't be burned by the fire that I hold. This fire's too small to hurt me. Why, it's actually grown cold. But that is due to scar tissue built up from years of play with making little fires which leave little scars that stay. And now I stand at Sodom's gate and hear that ghastly roar of maddened lechers groping blindly for the handle on Lot's door. And I hear the piercing cry of warning from God's angels bringing doom. Get out! Fly from here! The end is coming soon! And I'm just like Lot. I linger in my dreams, thinking that it cannot be as serious as it seems. One more day like this can't hurt me. It's not that big a deal. In fact, I'll start tomorrow, and the changes will be real. Oh God, send down your angels. Have them thrust me out the gate. For on my own I'll never make it. Something will make me wait. Without your heavenly push, I won't even make a start. For I am Lot, and Sodom is in my heart.